Welcome. This is the Ontology Summit 2012 Track 3 Challenge for the Ontology and Big Data. And Mary Brady and Ernie Lucy are the co-chairs, and it's Thursday, February 9, 2012. Welcome. I'm Ernie Lucy. I'm with the National Coordination Office. Mary, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Mary Brady. I'm with the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Great. First of all, one of the things about this track is, or the track that we're on, track three, is the mission. And what we're trying to do is to identify appropriate objectives for an ontology and big data challenge. The goal will be to select a challenge showing benefits of ontology to big data that will satisfy one or more of our objectives. With me at the moment is George Strawn from the National Coordination Office, the director, and I'd like to say a few words.
Good day, everyone, Peter, and all you colleagues. Ernie asked me to say a couple words after we had a discussion yesterday. I'm always somewhat filled with fear and trembling when an amateur like me talks to professionals in this area like you, but here goes anyway. The big data, the NCO and the NITRD program has assembled a senior steering group in big data in general, and so the connection of big data to ontologies is obviously an intriguing idea, a better connection between the two. And one of the things I've opined about previously in the in my observation into the semantics and ontology world is the what I'll call the relationship between research and infrastructure. Now, I've been involved with various scientific projects over the last decades that dealt with the connection and sometimes the difficulty for lack of connection between research and infrastructure. I want to see where we stand on that particular subject with regard to both the Ontology Summit and the Ontology Challenge that Track 3 represents. For example, in the Big Data Working Group, there are three or four separate themes. One is research into fundamental aspects of dealing with big data. Another is big data infrastructure projects. A third is challenges, such as we're dealing with here. And a fourth is education and training to produce big data professionals to keep the whole area moving forward. There have been times in recent years when I've talked with semantic researchers and ask for developments that look to me like they would be immediately applicable in the use of semantic technology. And I've, on some occasions, I'm told, oh, well, that's just the infrastructure aspect of the business, and we don't do the infrastructure. We want to do the research. In some cases, the, quote, infrastructure, unquote, is difficult in part because it involves a lot of manual effort. I'm thinking in particular of the creation of large controlled vocabularies in which a semantic application can proceed. The existing example that I'm familiar with is the semantic Medline project at NLM, where the project depends heavily on the existence of the unified medical language system that has been under development for several decades at NLM, and it would be pretty difficult, if not impossible, for that project to have succeeded without standing on the shoulders of UMLS or some similar controlled vocabulary. I see immediate applications of that type of activity in other scientific domains, but the absence of a controlled vocabulary is a, if not the bottleneck that keeps the application from occurring. It would certainly be within my wish fulfillment reign if some type of a challenge, some dimension of the challenge could involve ways to mechanize or at least semi-automate the processes of doing things that are viewed as information infrastructure, such as controlled vocabularies, in order to galvanize more immediate applications of some of the semantic possibilities that we see on the horizon. So that's about all I want to say there, is just encourage everyone to be looking at either the automation of the infrastructure dimensions of potential semantic applications or other means for making sure that someone is able to do the equivalent of, and I hope in 2 years rather than 20 years, the equivalent for our purposes of a UMLS to facilitate projects such as Semantic Medline. Thank you, Ernie, and I don't know if at this point you take questions or whether you move on to the next process, but that's what I have to say at the moment.
Great. Thank you, George. We're going to hold this all questions till the end.
Great.
Thank you. Related questions to you. Okay. Let's go to slide 2. Yes. And I already stated the mission. Slide 3, please. Okay, we're going to be talking about the potential issues that can be addressed by challenges. For example, you might have limited resources. Can a challenge help you with it? We're going to focus on one more of these objectives that meet our constraints. Constraints, for example, such as the big data must be semi or unstructured data. It has to be multi-agency big data sets. And we also are going to be looking at one of the things that we recommend is that organizers be involved. Organizers you can find some at challenge.gov, and another organizer is NASA and Harvard University have established what they call NASA Tournament Lab, NTL. And they enable the government agencies to perform challenges. Next slide, 4. One of the National Coordination Office's goals is to enhance collaboration and accelerate agencies' adoption of advanced IT capabilities. The challenges are ideally suited to that. The Network and Information Technology Research and Development Agencies, which we represent or work with, work together to accelerate the deployment of the promising research technologies. And we hope to have a challenge which is multi-agency and meets all the requirements and helps everyone. Next slide, please. This next 3 slides are actually our potential issues. I'm not going to read them all, obviously. But, the major things we're talking about, we want to accelerate the adoption of ontological methods, maximize public awareness, and impact of research. We want to increase the number of agencies using ontologies, i.e. we want earlier adoption within the government. One of the problems we have is the growth of ontological implementations and technologies with big data constrained by the shortage of qualified personnel. It's not clear that there are enough people out there to meet the challenge of implementing ontologies and semantic web. Next slide, please. Are developers able to optimize the use of unstructured or semi-structured data sets for scientists and engineers? You can talk to a lot of programmers and developers, and they talk about ontologies and structured data, but it's few of them that have a detailed knowledge of it. Scientists and engineers without ontology training may use brute force programming. This can be inefficient, and the scientists and engineers without training may not be aware of options and capabilities using ontology-based technologies. The programmers are also not knowledgeable of the scientists and engineers' domains as well, so you've got a mismatch in terms of communication. Next slide, please. What we want to do, one of the things we'd like to do, is increase the number of individuals capable of applying ontology technologies. And, of course, a challenge can substantially implement an organization's limited resources and provide innovative approaches. there's always the question of how an organization can implement semantic web technologies. Next slide, please. And what I've done is just list a few of the potential challenges. This is a little bit more focused than just stating issues. We want to increase the number of qualified personnel. We want to accelerate agencies' adoption of semantic and ontology capabilities. Next slide, please. The process we're going to go through is, you know, one is the process can benefit from challenge organizations. I mentioned the NASA Tournament Lab. Hopefully the process we go through will result in a what we hope to spur or areas that need work. We hope to improve them. Next slide, please. These are the panelists we're going to be talking, that are going to be speaking today. They'll be going in turn as displayed here. And at the end, we'll have discussions, and you're encouraged to jot down any questions into the chat area in the meantime. And the panelists, please introduce yourself before speaking. And we will begin with Barry Smith. Barry?
I'm here. Can you hear me? Can I request that you manage my slides? I'll just say next. And I'll introduce myself. I am the director of the National Center for Ontological Research in Buffalo. I've been working in this field for several decades, believe it or not. Buffalo has a master's and a PhD program in ontology, and we are at the moment creating an online graduate certificate program in ontology. And I have been working with the Ontology Summit, I think, since the beginning. NCORE is one of the sponsors of the Ontology Summit. Next. So my background is in philosophy, but I ceased to be a philosopher some 10 years ago. Since then, I've been working in ontology, which I regard as a branch of science rather than a branch of philosophy. And I've been collaborating initially almost exclusively with people in biomedicine. And more recently, I've been working with the DOD and with other agencies in order to try and apply the lessons we learned from the biomedical big data challenges brought about by the Human Genome Project to apply those lessons to other areas. And the approach that the biologists have taken with the maximal success can be described as a strategy of annotation. This means that big data collections are maintained as they are. The ontologies are used to tag these data collections, creating what are called annotations, and the annotations are maintained separately from the databases themselves. The annotations provide a net-centric reference for the data because each annotation includes an ontology term which involves a URL link to an ontology page. The ontologies are formulated using formal languages such as OWL, which means that they provide the potential for reasoning with the big data. But the immediate benefit, and these benefits are overwhelming, are in search and retrieval. Next. So this is a very old slide, but it still illustrates the main point. String searches yield only partial results. If you have a body of data which has been annotated using ontologies, then if the ontologies are well-structured, search simply becomes more complete and also becomes tunable in a variety of very useful ways. Okay? Now, these are some examples where I believe the same method will work. So biology I've already mentioned. This is just one example of hundreds of successful annotation projects in the areas of biology and medicine. The Army is pursuing a very promising effort in the human resources domain run by a man called Denis Wisnowski, who I presume will be part of this summit at some point. The Army Intelligence is initiating a similarly large and very heterogeneous data annotation project based in ontology, which you can find an initial description of at this link here. Very soon, I believe that we will be able to publish very, very impressive data about the success of this project. Then other areas where I do not know of what work is going on, but which are obvious, potentially fruitful areas for the method are crime data, insurance data, finance data, and so forth. Next. Let me just emphasize that I believe that the initial prime benefit is in terms of search and retrieval. Identifying potential outliers. In biology, we're already at the point where we're doing genuine reasoning, which means, for instance, virtual testing of hypotheses about the etiology of disease. And much of this reasoning is based on the use of OWL. OWL is now rather easy to use in the sense that there are tools like Protégé which people can learn rather quickly and start applying to the building of ontology. Now, this is, of course, a bad thing. The more people try to build ontology, the more bad ontologies will be created. And this will create new semantic silos. Now, this is the only important point I want to make in this presentation. That the idea of ontology is to bring benefits to search and retrieval by creating common annotations across multiple heterogeneous local databases. The common annotations have to use a highly constrained vocabulary. If everybody can create their own vocabulary and use it for annotation, the method will fail. The method is failing, in fact. Next. So we are recreating in the ontology world the very same problems in the database world which ontologies were trying to solve. The reason for this has to do with an attitude of mind in the computer world according to which it's good to create new things. In the ontology world, it's bad to create new things. It's good to reuse existing things, providing those existing things are serving a purpose. The argument for creating new things is manifold. One example of this argument is that there are no good ontologies in any case, so we might as well build many bad ones. Another argument is that the information technology is going to change, and so it's not worth the effort of building good ontology. All of these arguments, I think, are spurious. Next. And the reason I think they're spurious is because we have some experience in biology of the benefits of building good ontologies and of propagating these ontologies among large communities of people. Make it profitable for people to reuse these ontologies and thereby avoid the silo effect. Next. And if you look at the history of ontology, this is a rather old slide yet again, but you can see that there is a certain growth in the use of ontology in the biomedical research world as documented by the PubMed database of biomedical journal article. Next. If you look at these articles, however, you see that overwhelmingly and increasingly overwhelmingly, it's only one ontology which is being used, and this is the gene ontology. Now, the gene ontology illustrates the methodology which I advocate. It is an ontology which is intended to be a well-curated, well-maintained, stable, authoritative, controlled vocabulary for describing biological processes, for describing cellular components, and for describing molecular functions. It only has terms for those three kinds of entities. and those terms are created by biologists with clear logical definitions. And they, the terms and definitions are updated as the ontology is applied for purposes of annotation. Next. So Go provides a controlled vocabulary which is multi-species and multidisciplinary and open source and is subject to a rigorous governance process. So the way to do this thing right in order that it will actually work is we need to mimic the methodology used by the Go. And in biology, we have formulated a set of principles for doing this, and we have now several ontologies which are satisfying these principles, which apply the Go method to other areas of biology in addition to the three areas covered by the Go. All the ontologies in the OBO Foundry are developed in a coordinated way, subject to the same system of governance, and all are being developed incrementally in a way that builds on the lessons learned from earlier stages. The only way we're going to solve the big data challenge is if we can replicate something like the OBO Foundry in each successive area. And that's the end of my remarks.
Chris, do you want to begin yours?
Thank you, everyone, for allowing me to speak here at this summit. I'm actually very interested in hearing from everyone else as well, and so I'm hoping that that you have some questions at the end. I know that we'll wait to the end for that, but. My name is Chris Musilek. I'm the Chief Software Architect for Data.gov, and I'm actually here in place of Jean Holmes. She was unable to make it. She actually had a family emergency to go to, so I kind of stepped in her place at the last minute. So most of the slides here that I have are her slides, and I am not going to use them very much because I would like to focus on one aspect that we're working on at data.gov that has a lot of relation to the semantic web. But first, let me just give a quick overview for those of whom aren't familiar with data.gov. Data.gov is the federal government's clearinghouse for open data sets. And it provides a central place to easily find, download, and use data sets for a variety of new and unintended purposes. The idea was created out of the Obama administration's Open Government Directive that promotes innovation, transparency, and collaboration. And data.gov promotes transparency through the openness of releasing, providing this central place to for folks to go to find data across the entire federal government. And really what we tried to do at the data.gov team, we're actually a really tiny team, is to create a data ecosystem. And the second slide that Jean had provided, we work to try to gather data from as many different places and give it freely to developers, scientists, and citizens, in a useful format. We also try to connect the community to help to find solutions to allow collaboration around those data sets. We also provide sort of an infrastructure built on standards in order to help to facilitate that. We have a couple of things in our environment that allow for data to be exposed via APIs as well as through a triple store that we do have. We encourage technology developers to create apps and maps and visualizations through different challenges, through different events, and we're always looking to try to gather more data and connect more people. The next slide. So data.gov actually provides instant access to over 450,000. This is a slightly older number in easy-to-use formats. And there's contributions from all over the place, from many different agencies. We hope that this helps to encourage the development of innovative applications and to drive innovation as part of this around the globe. So that's sort of a basic overview of data.gov. And what I'd like to do, because of the folks here, is to talk about some of the semantic web less of the benefits of using the semantic web, but how more we can encourage agencies to begin to use the semantic web, and sort of the semantic web ontologies. One of the efforts that we are working on that I am trying to push as part of my role in data.gov is an initiative called vocab.data.gov. It's currently not live, but it is a subdomain that we will be setting up soon, really to provide a place for federal agencies to publish their data vocabularies and ontologies in one place, using dereferenceable URIs on the definition of metadata and the identification of instance data according to typical linked data publishing practices. And the idea here is to allow developers and data architects to search for and view what vocabularies are currently being used by federal government agencies. To the speaker before me, I talked about the importance of interoperability. That certainly is an eventual goal looking to the future. But as a first step, we just want to know what vocabularies exist in the federal government. And so providing some simple way for federal agencies to publish those, we think is valuable. There currently exists no source for finding vocabularies currently being used by the federal government data sets. In fact, the data.gov data catalog does provide some basic metadata. One of the things that it does lack is sort of in a machine-readable way, data dictionary. So the same idea of ontologies. And so having a place to search for those will help with the discovery of data and greatly assist with its reuse, beginning to encourage people to talk about what different things exist, why they might be different, or more importantly, how are they the same and ways that they may want to reuse one or another, rather than building one on their own, so allowing vocabularies to converge. So the other part of why we're doing vocab.data.gov is just what I was mentioning before, in that data.gov metadata suffers from this lack of data dictionaries that is extremely useful for many people to get a better understanding of what that data is, and which of course is necessary if we want to be able to reuse it in a meaningful way. So sort of looking to the future, one of the things beyond sort of setting this up is we hope to converge on vocabularies. Viewing them side by side, similar and overlapping ones become more apparent and just provide the means to talk about them. We also, to encourage them, the agencies to begin to use this, we want to tie these or incorporate the linked data practices into our own tools and workflow. So providing, we do have a means to get data online onto data.gov that agencies or data stewards use. And as a first step, we could fairly easily publish our own metadata template as a vocabulary, so that our own tool, in essence, uses the URIs based on the classes or the metadata template class, so to speak, in our own tool. And so that's one of the things where we hope to do. We also can encourage agencies by requiring them to publish their data, their vocabulary alongside of the metadata that they pose for each data set. Some of the other things that we're thinking about to help to encourage agencies is to publish some high-value vocabularies. There are certain ones that are used across a much wider swath of data sets than others. One in particular is, of course, just the list of federal government agencies. To this point, there really isn't, that I'm aware of, any sort of canonical list of agencies, federal government agencies, that is in a machine-readable format. So we would like to just publish that list and begin to use that list and to encourage others to use it as well. And so we think that vocab.data.gov would be a good place for that. Beyond that, I think sort of looking even farther to the future, we hope to be able to build ecosystems that are building metadata tools that focus on data consumption for sort of data owners. So having sort of a service that provides URI endpoints with vocabularies eventually, would we want to encourage different metadata tools to begin to use and consume those services and hopefully kind of bring about that change? And of course, telling stories about it and building visualizations with it are certainly very powerful in helping to convince folks who aren't necessarily researchers, sort of folks that kind of pay the bills and make decisions to help to understand the power of what can be done using linked data standards. Sort of the last bit that I just want to kind of point out in how we are trying to encourage agencies, like I had mentioned early on, our team is actually very small, and we want to, it's very important to us, particularly to me, to leverage the research in the academic communities to help us with this. So in sort of the essence that you guys are working to promote challenges around these things, we look at that as we want to help however we can help with that. We really are interested in having researchers and academics work with us to help to promote and move semantic web data and ontologies forward in the federal government. So thank you.
The next speaker is Brian Thompson. Brian?
Yes, hello. I'm going to approach this from a little bit of a different angle. Yeah, I'm Brian Thompson. I'm with SysTap. We are the developers of an open source platform called Big Data. The company goes back about 6 years. And we've been working with semantic web technologies, originally starting in the intelligence community space and now increasingly in the private sector. Big data as an architecture was inspired by, like some other open source projects, inspired by things that were happening at the time at Google, including their MapReduce system and their Bigtable system. But it takes a fairly different approach, and I'll touch on that a little bit, but I don't want to focus too much on our own platform here. Next slide. And this is just information about SysTap, what we do, and you're welcome to look at this. I just wanted to provide it to people. Next slide. So big data, as it's talked about most broadly, is a way of thinking about massive amounts of data. People will tell you, you know, that the scale may reflect your own problems and capabilities, but we tend to think that big data architectures are ones that are capable of hitting a petabyte scale, that they're intrinsically based on distributed processing, that there are several trends which have been driving this. The CPUs hit a performance wall a while ago, and this has necessitated parallelism. This has gone on both in terms of increasing the cores on chips, increasing the numbers of chips in machines, but especially in lateral scaling, having multiple machines. And Google was really one of the leaders here with large data centers of commodity hardware that were running distributed software. And they did this first with their distributed file system, then with their MapReduce system and Bigtable system and several other systems since then. Another part of all of this is open source. Because of the sheer costs involved with licensing when you get into systems of this scale, open source has become really... It goes hand in hand, I think, with this definition of big data. And there are several communities who are involved with big data. Go to the next slide. And some of these are reflected here, but there are also ones which are out of the traditional high-performance computing space. And this is actually a territory that's fairly decoupled from the people who are involved with the ROSE and MapReduce processing. Big Data itself, as our software platform, is really a parallel or clustered database architecture. And so it's different from the other kinds of systems which are represented here. Can we actually, at this point, skip two slides? I just want to jump the order for a second.
Could you call out the slide number? Because we probably
seven.
Have like 1,000 times more audience later. So if you call the number out, it will help them get synced up quickly.
Yes. Slide 7, please. Okay. So this is where we tend to be coming from when we talk about dealing with big data and what is sort of the killer app for big data. And again, this looks at these different trends which have been going on. The need for parallelism in terms of processing in order to get increased throughput on applications. The emergence of open standards for semantics and data and querying that data. And our focus is really on the ability to rapidly exploit and often in an ad hoc manner new data sets as they become available. And we've seen this in a number of different areas. For example, there's a company, Garlic, in the UK, and they deal with fraud information. And they use semantics because it allows them to integrate new data sources that they have not interacted with before on a very rapid basis. And that's where the critical information value is locked up. So if I have a message here, it's that one of the critical applications when you deal with these large amounts of data from these very different data sources is to bring them together as rapidly as you can and then accept some trade-off in the amount of semantic alignment which is used as those data are fused to handle some of that through query and to be able to exploit that information in a timely manner. Now, if we can jump back to slide 5. So this is a notion of timeliness versus completeness, and we're on one side of it, but there are good applications on both sides of this, but they're simply separate worlds. So on the one side, you can rapidly exploit the fusion of multiple data sources, and this can get down to a period of minutes or hours. We've seen this in the intelligence community where people will be tasked with a problem, and they'll go out looking for information sources, and they need to pull them in immediately and apply them immediately. The turnaround is extremely short. There are, on the other hand, sort of to go to the other extreme, there are applications where you need highly curated knowledge and you want to apply high-level reasoning across that knowledge and get out inferences and impacts on the processes like knowledge discovery and bioinformatics where the reasoning must be correct or must have very small error margins. Otherwise, the tools become distrusted very quickly. And these processes of creating that data and curating it and taking care of it take an enormous amount of time and energy. And so if you're going to be looking at expressivity, you're naturally moved into having highly curated information, and especially if you're going to be looking at expressivity at scale. And if you're going to be looking at this rapid exploitation world, then less ontology can often be more. You may want to have certain things about which there are core agreements so that you can rapidly pull in new data sets and begin to exploit them. Next slide, please. Slide 6. So when it comes to expressivity and scale, there's quite a bit of computational cost associated with more expressive ontologies. And a very common response, and this is similar, perhaps, to something that Smith was saying earlier, is that because there are all these tools for creating OWL ontologies, people seem to feel that this is what they should be doing. But the ontologies that they're creating are not necessarily ones that can be used to reason over data at any kind of significant scale. Okay, if we could skip to slide 8, just going past the one that we had already seen. So there are a couple of things that we think are important and that we built into the architecture of big data as a software platform from the beginning. And one of these is provenance. And I'm sure that everybody believes that provenance is radically important. But one of the things when you deal with a large data scale is not just you need to know where the information came from, but that the increase in data volume from having provenance about your information can be tremendous. When you go through an RDF reification, you will turn one statement into 4 or 5, depending on how you do it. And at any significant data scale, that's a tremendous increase in the amount of data on the disk, and it can really impact the cost of the solutions, the amount of hardware that's required. So, provenance has to be handled specially at the technology layer, and we need to have better standards for this. All of the database vendors are dealing with provenance in custom ways. One of the other reasons why pulling provenance into the data model, the way we do it is we give every assertion, every statement its own identity, and you can talk about these things as if they're blank nodes, and then you can query your data as if it was laid out as simple statements and not as reified statements. And I think tremendously reduces the cognitive complexity of writing queries against the information. And then you can get at the metadata, the statements about the statements, by just pulling out what's effectively the graph position, the context position of each statement. So this is a topic where there needs to be more evolution and standards need to develop for this. It was something that was initially left out of the W3C standards specifically because Tim Berners-Lee believed that second-order calculus, predicate calculus, was too computationally expensive, and he wanted to avoid things which he felt would of necessity fail. But at the same time, by leaving statements about statements out of the mix, it's seriously handicapped a lot of applications. One of the common things that people will run into is just this question then about how do you model a relationship, and now you need to go back and you need to talk about that relationship such as when did some event happen? And this is, of course, another way in which provenance architectures come into play. We're also great fans of micro-architectures, micro-ontologies, small ontologies that deal with the system or with those gross features of an application domain which are easy to recognize and can be rapidly aligned and allow you to exploit information quickly. Next slide, please. So this touches on more of the systems architecture of big data platforms, and it's called a CAP theorem, and it refers to these properties of consistency, availability, and partition tolerance. And the CAP theorem basically says that you can only have 2 out of 3, and you need to make a choice as to what you're going to be leaving out of the mix. So one of the other consequences of moving to very large information sets when you begin to process them is you have to decide what you don't need, what you can live without. The particular choice that we took in the big data architecture was to sacrifice consistency on updates. So we deal with updates which are shard-wise ACID and then give people application-level protocols where they can get a globally consistent read-behind point for a particular data set. But there is a trade-off, and people need to think about this question for a given application. What can you do without? But you cannot have all of these. Next slide, please. And then finally, again, at sort of the systems architecture side, is a question of how these very large-scale systems get deployed. And there's it's very important to go after the separation between the compute side and the storage side, to be able to manage these things separately. This is actually not something that we did initially, and so we can tell you very much from hindsight that it's important. But it's also important because this is how many of these resources are managed. If you want to go out and deploy on Amazon, you know, you have your EC2 and your S3 side. And this is also true when you look at a systems administration side of private clouds. These things tend to be managed separately, and the system architecture has to map onto that and provide separate management for the computing which is going on and the durable storage which is associated with it. And I believe that's it.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Jim, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. Hope everybody can hear me. I'm not able to access the VNC, so I'll have my own private slides. I hope everybody can follow along. I'm Jim Kirby. I'm a software engineering researcher at the NAVID Research Lab. What I'd like to discuss are two ways in which I think ontologies might be useful to software production, which I'll define in a minute. First, to inform the creation of software methods and tools. And I'd thank George Strawn for suggesting this to me. And second, to facilitate the collection of software production data across projects, organizations, industries, and economies to enable an evidence-based understanding of software production, which is currently lacking. And I claim that it's useful to think of all this data as being big data. Okay, moving on to the slide number two. By software production, I'm including software creation, its sustainment or evolution, and its assurance. And this definition assumes that we're building systems that take years to develop and have decades of operation. And since for software to continue to be relevant, it has to evolve over decades, sustainment's very important to that. We think of software production as a decision-making process, and so the questions that come to mind are, what are those decisions, how are they recorded, and how are they organized? And this information seems well-suited for capturing in an ontology. And then instantiating the ontology can describe the design of a particular system. Moving on to slide three is an example ontology. This is a work in progress that's being developed in a project that I'm working on. And I'm just going to say a few words about the yellow frames in this model, which is a frame-based model showing frames and slots. Up in the top right are decisions, so almost everything's is considered part of a decision, and also important are things that aren't decisions, which are assumptions and rationale, but they're not folded into this model yet. Part of the decisions have to do with the environment of the system, which includes the system itself and everything that's relevant to that system. Let's see. So you can see there's system components and then things that are not system, which I'm not sure I need to have in there, but I just have it as a placeholder. Important to this ontology are attributes, which are all the things that the system has to, essentially all the things the system has to care about. It describes its behavior by the attributes whose value it controls. And then up in the top, just below decision, there are functions which give the value of the decisions, or the attributes, excuse me, that the system controls. Okay. Moving on to slide four, talking about understanding software production. We currently have an inadequate anecdotal understanding of software production. How do we create and sustain the software infrastructure in response to changing needs and technologies? That's one of the primary challenges of software production. To understand it, there are a few examples of large-scale data collection, so we just don't have good data we can use to try to understand this phenomenon. There's little standardization of data, which probably piques the ears of ontologists in the audience, I hope. And the production is performed in a wide variety of industrial settings, and I've listed some of them there. And as I've already mentioned, what evidence we have is often anecdotal or based on small-scale trials. Moving on to slide 5, to talk a bit about software production data itself, one of the things we're really interested in are decisions that were considered, rejected, made, or changed, because we expect, of course, these decisions to change. We want to maintain the rationale about them. And then some examples of particular software artifacts. There are formal ones, source and executable code, specifications, and so on. Structured informal artifacts, which have a standard form but are often code, often text, so pseudocodes, sort of text, requirements, there's graphical models, and so on. And also the email addressing information and subject if you want to understand how people in a project are communicating among themselves. That information can be very useful. And then there are unstructured artifacts, so the actual body of emails, notes, code comments, etc. Moving on to slide 6, software production we're thinking of as an information process, and it was defined by Denning as a sequence of representations. So this is how to think about the software production data, or is going to lead to it. So a software production representation is a union of all the existing artifacts for a project at some point in time. And then the sequence of representations is demarcated by the creation of artifacts and changes to them over time. So as the software production project moves along over time, you can think of it as each time a new artifact is created or each time a change is checked into a version control library, you have a new representation. And you can think of this as the state space of software production. Slide 7, just to talk a little bit about a particular software production information process, we have data from the open source Mozilla core project back in May. And it involved over 13 years, almost 1,400 developers, almost 11 million lines of code and comments. And the representations were over 200,000. There's over 200,000 representations in this information process. So you can think of the state space of the Mozilla core software to production as being over 200,000 representations times an average of, say, 5 million lines of code and comment. Note that the artifacts, for this particular example, artifacts other than code were not considered. There's no idea of how many emails were passed around to understand among the participants to understand how they were communicating among themselves. It's not a particularly large project. It's large but not immense, and it's just one OSS, one open source software project versus all the commercial projects, versus all the contracted developed government projects, so on across all the various industries. Okay, and so that's what I have to say, and I guess questions come at the end. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jim. Peter, how do you want to run the discussions here?
Okay, generally at this time, we want people to push the hand button if they have some remarks to make or if they have a question to ask any of the panelists, and we shall queue people up as their hands show on the queue. And I guess one of the chairs, either Ernie or Mary, could call upon each person, or since you know the panel, maybe call upon a panelist to address the issue raised. And we already have a bunch of questions on the chat. So people who had written something on the chat, please queue up, because we probably want to verbally discuss those as well. And people who have remarks that they made, please try to document them on the chat as well, because the chat transcript becomes part of the proceedings for the session. So over to you. And already, we already have a couple of hands up. And please click on the hand button so that you get onto the queue, everyone. Oh, by the way, when you're recognized, please do a *7 to unmute your phone. Say something first. Make sure the chair recognizes you before you start speaking. Otherwise, I mean, you're liable to be speaking into a vacuum. A lot of people muted their own phone as well, so be careful. You have to unmute your own phone if you have muted yourself. I guess Ernie and Mary, you probably want to leave your phone unmuted so that you could address questions as they come along. Most of the speakers could do that too. Most noises are generally created by people calling in from other areas, and we have had people calling from in from Russia, from South Africa, Malaysia, and so on. Those are particularly noise generating, those connections. So those need to be muted all the time if we want a clean line. So back to you, Ernie and Mary.
Mary, do you want to work the discussion?
Sure, I can do this. Let me know, Peter, if this is correct. In front of my screen, I see a queue with Barry Smith and Todd Schneider.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Okay. So, given that Barry is at the top of the list, let's start with Barry.
Hello, I have a quick question for Brian. I agreed with a lot of what you said, Brian, but I heard you talk about micro-ontologies at one stage, and you said that micro-ontologies were easy to align. And now, I agree with you, but I also see micro-ontologies as being easy to create redundancies within the system and conflicts, and generally to be a source of failure rather than a source of success. And I'm sorry to repeat myself, but I really think that most of our energies are going to be wasted unless we find a way of governing the creation of ontologies. So I'm just wondering whether you have a strategy for doing that.
So the context in which we see applications of micro-ontologies are really ones in which there might be, there's often an effort to create overly detailed ontologies that are capturing distinctions which are too subtle for people using the system to understand, and which can, if you take an ontology first approach for some applications, can cause significant time lag in actually being able to build and deploy that application. And so when I'm suggesting micro-ontologies, I'm really advocating sort of an evolution of an ontology as needed by a given system, making the minimum sets of distinctions which are useful for that application. I have absolutely nothing against reuse of ontologies. I think that reuse is marvelous, and I completely understand the point that you're bringing up about how the more ontologies you have, the more of an alignment problem you have. This is absolutely true. And I think, as you've suggested, and I think as the DataDocGov people were suggesting, that a social dimension is necessary to minimizing the redundancy across ontologies.
Very good.
Thank you, Brian. Are you satisfied, Barry?
I'm satisfied, yes. To the extent that I'm ever satisfied.
No, and I'm glad you brought it up. As you were presenting, I knew what Brian was going to present, and I picked up on that as well, that you're at different ends of the spectrum to some degree, with one purporting that the way to go is rigorous ontologies that go through well-defined process, and micro-ontologies possibly being at the other end of the spectrum. Todd, I think you're next.
Mary, I should be unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Please go ahead.
This is a question for James. James, looking at your material, can I infer that you might suggest you need to do away with UML and replace it with something more useful?
Can I talk now?
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm not a big fan of UML, but we need to find more useful things, so that would be a fair statement.
Thank you.
Frank, Chum, you're next.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I certainly can.
Good, thanks. This question is for Barry and probably Brian as well. Barry, you mentioned the silo effect, and can you say something about how to avoid it in such a way that I think again referring to Brian, the micro ontology, I think that may turns out to having, you know, silos effect for these having little micro ontologies. But anyway,
the way that we have been attempting to avoid it in biology goes something like this. New groups move into biological research. They confront new kinds of problems. And so they eventually, sooner or later, discover that they need an ontology for their domain. The problem is that seven people in different parts of the world might create such an ontology for the same domain simultaneously, and they will each do it differently.
Right.
So the first task, and I think this was raised in the remarks about data.gov earlier in the discussion, the first task is to make sure that there is an absolute attention to information sharing so that before anybody creates an ontology, they declare their intention and request other people who may already have created such an ontology or have initiated such a creation process will collaborate with them. And eventually, we need to go further and ensure that people in different domains start to build their ontologies in such a way that they're using the same top-level architecture, they're using the same relations, they're using the same strategy for creating definitions and so forth. And all of those things are being practiced successfully in some groups within the biological and clinical research world, not everywhere, but within some influential groups. And they're now also being practiced outside biology and medicine by some groups. So information sharing, common architecture, and then collaborative governance, I think, are probably the best way of summarizing it.
Yes, thank you. That's very helpful because I'm actually in a process of trying to foster something going on in the oil and gas and chemical industry for having these, ontology something similar to your ontology foundry kind of process. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe Eric Chan is next. Eric, are you there?
Yes, this is Eric Chan. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Please go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for Barry. I posted the question earlier. The question is, as a software engineer, we benefited a lot from design patterns, especially pattern catalog in the Gang of Four book. It promotes reuse, and some of these reuse are higher level abstractions. So do you see the use of ontology pattern language to document ontologies to promote reuse and to avoid silos and or including providing instructions for how a new ontologist will be able to reuse existing ontologies and to improve their own worldview?
I'm becoming increasingly friendly towards the idea of design patterns. I think part of what design patterns bring is brought by a good top-level ontology. I think design patterns could help when it comes to training ontologists, since we're only going to achieve the kind of consistency that's needed if we can have a common body of knowledge that ontologists are trained in. At the moment, ontologists are very rarely trained. They Google the word ontology and then go and do their business. I'm still exploring the degree to which we can indeed create design patterns which will be useful in ways which common architecture and common information sharing don't already achieve what's needed. But generally speaking, I'm becoming more sympathetic to the idea.
Okay, thank you. And
thank you, Eric and Barry. Art, I believe you're next. Star 7 to unmute.
Oh, Bart just wrote up on the chat that he doesn't have a microphone.
No microphone.
So can you see what he's put down? Maybe you can paraphrase that for him.
Okay, let me see. Barry Smith and Chris Musiak's presentation touched on the data analysis of raw data. Barry's example was search. Chris's included search visualization. I believe analyses on large data sets such as machine learning can help with this. My main motivation is the following. Instead of statistical interpretation, mean, standard deviation, mode, etc., we can show semantic relations of data and analyze it at a more abstract level. Barry's work on ontology granulation is related to this. There is work on creating decision trees using OWL, and there's a reference below in the chat. The uncertainty in reasoning for the semantic web workshop is also related to this, although dealing with ontologies themselves, not necessarily incorporating data. Proposals to achieve this include extending ontologies with data, associating data with ontologies, using machine learning on ontologically enhanced data. Are there any efforts along these lines? Is anyone interested in using this approach to analyze data?
I can say one or two things. First of all, there is a community which works on an ontology called OBI, which is the Ontology for Biomedical Investigation, which is attempting to find a controlled vocabulary to describe experimental methods and also single experiments. And they are interested, for instance, in finding a way in which an outsider can find all the experiments carried out in Pittsburgh in 2017, which involved the use of specific kinds of gels in relation to specific kinds of amino acids in connection with research on cancer, that kind of question. They are very heavily into the idea of extending ontologies with data. Secondly, associating data with ontologies is really just what I was talking about earlier when I was using the word annotation. So an annotation links an ontology term to a specific piece of data and thereby makes the data findable, retrievable through the ontology, which turns out to be a very useful way of not just of retrieving data, but also of making the data extended by means of semantic technologically based reasoning. The third idea is an idea which is often talked about in the biology world. So generally speaking, machine learning and also NLP and similar methods in biology are not really succeeding. But the view is, and this is a view which is accepted in some circles with some evidence of success, although not yet, sufficient evidence to be really confident, the idea is being discussed that if you have not raw data to which you apply your machine learning algorithms, but ontologically enhanced data, then you will get significantly better results. I believe that that ought to be true, but we need more data before we know whether it's true.
Right, and I can also add as well, this is Chris Musilek, that the associating data with ontologies was also precisely what I was sort of mentioning with connecting our workflow tools with a place to publish vocabularies so that you can sort of make those connections. I think earlier in the chat, one person had asked about the 6.7 billion triples that we have, and we actually didn't use any vocabularies or data dictionaries in the creation of that. And with linking ontologies with some of the data sets that exist in data.gov, we could have built better algorithms to help to associate in essence produce better linked data. So those are definitely things that we think are really important as we move forward.
Thank you, Brian. I noticed that you posted some information on the chat regarding the use of GPU computers to speed up some of these operations. Did you have something to add?
Well, I think this has been, I think the GPUs are very interesting technology and still a bit of a sleeper in the space of these large-scale systems. They're used in the high-performance computing world and some of the largest supercomputers, but they have not really hit the quote-unquote big data space of commodity hardware platforms, but I think they're extremely interesting. One of the performance barriers which has been only aggravated over the last decade is the memory bandwidth, how much access to memory there is or how much delay in accessing memory there is for a CPU. And so for deeply pipelined CPUs, you'll find that they're stalling very frequently because they're constantly hitting a need to fetch out of their cache and into main memory. GPUs have a much higher bandwidth to memory, and they're capable of doing operations which parallelize well extremely quickly. And there are now general programming languages for them based on C and bridges from Java to them. So it's a very interesting technology, and we've been looking at how to introduce GPU co-processing into the platform. We really don't have anything to report yet there, but I think it's something that's well worth looking at further.
Thank you, Brian. Peter, Yim, I believe you're next on the in the queue.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Since we're talking about talking to different members from communities that are quite different from the ontology community, and I think there is a need to clarify where ontologists stand. I mean, with respect to people in semantic web or in software engineering, modeling, conceptual modeling, and those. Since Barry is our ontologist on the panel, and we also have Leo Oberst, one of the general co-chairs among us, maybe can we call upon Barry and Leo to sort of give us a position where ontologists possibly stand or differentiate from people in software engineering that are doing similar things, modeling, and also from semantic web or W3C type people?
Yes, thank you.
Why doesn't Leo go first?
Leo?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yes.
Okay, great. It's kind of a complicated question, but I'll keep it simple. Typically in ontology, if you want an expressive ontology, you need something more, let's say, such as first order logic and maybe even beyond that. However, For runtime reasoning, runtime use, you typically have to make do with less. So semantic web technologies, we actually strongly advocate them as steps towards better ontologies if discipline and guidelines are given so that not everyone writes their own ontology, but you reuse and you make sure the quality is good. You may want to have expressive ontologies and then reduce it in a sense to a less expressive ontology such as ENOW. And we actually advocate doing that too. And I know, Barry and others have gone this route. You might want common logic expressivity, but you may have a variant of your ontology which is expressed in OWL simply because everyone is more familiar with the technologies involved, and you can still get quite a lot of leverage using OWL. So I guess that's it for now. For reasoning purposes, there's many issues. It's hard to do efficient runtime reasoning using first-order logic. Theorem provers really aren't not very efficient. But if you can reduce a very expressive ontology, let's say in common logic or first-order logic, to an OWL ontology using maybe knowledge compilation methods and logic programming, you may be able to have a pretty efficient runtime reasoner that uses a slightly reduced expressive, slightly less expressive ontology at runtime, but it's still linked more directly to that more expressive ontology. That's probably it for now. Thanks.
Thanks, Leo.
And I agree with everything Leo said. I have nothing to add.
Thanks, Barry. Todd Snyder, I think you're back to the top of the list.
Another question for Barry.
Yes.
Barry, you mentioned during your presentation that up at the University of Buffalo, you're developing an online course for training ontologists. Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah. So we are starting with a graduate certificate program.
We lost you, Barry.
I know, Barry, I think we lost you.
Well, perhaps you can type it in the chat box.
Or call back in.
Barry, are you there?
His phone connection probably got dropped. So
I think you're probably right.
Get him in the chat. Yeah.
So maybe we should move on to the next question, and we'll come back to Barry in just a moment. Bob Schloss?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I just want to add something because I wrote something in the chat about 30 minutes ago when we listened to Jim Kirby talk about ontologies and understanding software production. And what I'd written in the chat was referencing work of some of my colleagues in IBM Software Group, specifically Rational, and they're developing processes in which projects sort of define their overarching processes and methodologies, and they have kind of a menu of styles, of procedures. But the main point I really want to say is what's clever about what they're doing is that all stakeholders get value about contributing data using standard descriptions. A lot of ontology stuff kind of seems to me to be, well, if you bother classifying or tagging or whatever, someone else down the road will get value because you did this and lots of other people did it. But there's no immediate payoff for you. So what I appreciate about what Rational and there's about 12 other companies that are evolving this so-called jazz architecture for software lifecycle. What these 13 companies are doing is they're really carefully defining a family of interrelated vocabularies. One has to do with requirements capture, and one has to do with build, and one with testing, and et cetera, et cetera. So they're defining these, and then they're defining tools so that whoever has to label what they're doing or an artifact they're contributing, they themselves get value out of it, but also the project as a whole. So I'm not sure. That's basically all I want to say. And I put in the chat links to two websites where a lot of their detail is done.
Thank you, Bob. Jim, did you have any response? Or?
This is Jim Kirby again. I hope you can hear me. I have not looked at jazz architecture, but the point he makes, I think, is good, that how can we – well, this sounds like really an ontology shared among a number of companies, and that's how you're getting value. At least that's what it sounded like, and that sounds like a reasonable thing to do.
That's right. And in effect, almost no new concepts get introduced into the shared ontology until at least one program is one of the participating companies is going to actually introduce either a free or paid tool that both consumes and produces that structured data.
Okay. I'll have to tell you. You posted a link to that somewhere?
Yep.
Okay.
Jazz.net.
I see it. Okay. Yeah, okay. So that's worth looking at. Thanks for pointing that out. I wasn't familiar with it.
You're welcome.
I guess that's it for me.
Okay, thank you. It looks like Barry Smith is back on. Barry, are you there?
I hope so. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Good. So this is in response to Todd's question. The MA and PhD programs in ontology already exist. They are part of the philosophy department. Many of the courses, or a fraction of the courses, are philosophy. But we have courses dealing with ontology technology, and then we have a number of tracks, particularly in the biological and medical world, for people who want to focus on applied ontology in those domains. The online program that we are just initiating now will be an advanced graduate certificate program. We are starting the first courses towards the end of the summer. We'll have a course on protégé and a course on basic formal ontology. And you can find more details about those initial courses on my website. Both of them will be open to the public, but also open to people who want to register for credit, which will then be applied towards the advanced certificate program at a later stage. Any courses done for the advanced certificate will also count towards an MA if people want to go further.
Thank you, Barry. Peter, Jim, I think you're back up.
Yes, yes. While we're on this subject about education of ontologists, it's great. I mean, Barry is coming up with a course. And I guess for those who have been with the Ontology Summit for several years would have noted that 2 years ago, the future of ontologists and how to educate them was the theme of our summit, during which Barry was one of the general co-chairs along with Steve Ray. And along that line, I mean, since quite a few of us in the group are involved with IAOA, the International Association for Ontology and its applications, I would like to put in a plug about the summer school that IAOA is putting up this coming summer in Trento, Italy, right before the next FOIS conference, which is the Formal Ontology for Information Systems conference, the flagship conference for the formal ontology community. So maybe Leo could say a few more words about it, since Leo is intimately connected to people who are organizing that summer school.
Leo?
Yes. Can you hear me, folks?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, yes. So this is actually kind of the second instance. We had a summer institute for IAOA last year in Tuscany, and it was focused more on ontology, process ontology. But this year, it's going to be at Trento, and it'll be the week before the FOIS conference, which is in Austria. But the summer school will be actually at Trento, University of Trento. And, of course, the Trento folks are organizing it, Stefano Borgo and Claudio and Nicola Guarino, of course. And this is really like the first what we might call a summer school as opposed to an institute. So the summer school itself will have a range of courses from simple or introductory courses to more advanced courses and address, issues such as, what's ontological analysis, how does formal semantics and of natural language and cognitive science interact and with ontological analysis. And more advanced courses. It's basically intends to be structured like the ESSLI conference, which is basically a summer school that lasts for a week or two. That's been held in Europe almost every year for about 20 years or so, focusing on logic, language, and computation. And if people are familiar with that conference or with that summer school, it's basically, again, a range of courses, much, much more extensive than we're doing here with the ontology summer school. But this is our first one, so it's we hope to grow it in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
So if people want to go to Europe, this is an opportunity. Italy, Austria. I guess.
So I'm not seeing any more people queued up. Are there any more questions? Hey, Peter, I think I'll defer to you as to next steps.
Okay. If Ernie, you have other announcements, solicitations to put in?
Peter, no, I don't have any other announcements this time. We will end up with a challenge before the face-to-face, but we'll get into that later.
Okay. If that's the case, I just want to take the opportunity to announce that we will have the Track 4 session, same time next Thursday, February 16th, and it will be entitled Large Scale Domain Applications, the first session of that. Track 4 will have two sessions, as will Track 3. They have the one today, and then their next session would be on March 15th. Track 4 session next week, so it's coming up with domain applications and large-scale application scenarios. So come back next week, and I will pass it back to Ernie and Mary to thank our panelists. Ernie?
Yeah, I wish to thank all of the panels. I've been taking notes here while Mary's been talking, and it helps me a lot. Thank you. Mary?
Yes, I'd like to thank everyone as well. I think it's been an interesting discussion.
Great session.
And thank you.
Yeah. And as usual, the full proceedings will be up hopefully fairly quickly. Slides are already there. We'll have the recording as well as a sort of slightly cleaned up, rearranged chat transcript for everyone. So stay tuned and talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.